Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's really a treat to welcome back to the program today James McBride. He's got a new novel out. It's called The Good Lord Bird. He joins us by telephone from Seattle. Hello, James.
How you doing, Vic? How's it going?
Excellent. Really great to have you back on the program. I've been waiting for this book, and I'm happy to say it was worth the wait. How on earth did you ever come up with this idea?
Well, I mean, I was interested in John. I became interested in John Brown when I was in Maryland. I was at a historical society doing some research on my previous book, and I just saw a note. There was just a notice. It was some note about him in there, and I wasn't that far from Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. So I just took a ride down to Harpers Ferry. When I got to Harpers Ferry, I just became fascinated with him. You know, he was a fascinating guy. I mean, one of the most original Americans I can think of. You know, and so I decided to, investigate his life, and I came away with the belief that he was probably one of the most important Americans of the last 200 years.
And John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry was really like pouring gasoline on a very hot issue of slavery and abolition of slavery, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about John Brown that made it interesting was that he was driven by religion. He was a deeply religious guy who, you know, previous to the Harper's Ferry raid had been in Kansas, had gone out to Kansas to help his sons who had gone out there to settle the West. Most people don't realize that when the West was being settled, the government was basically giving away land, anyone who wanted to go out there. And so the issue of whether Kansas should be a free state or a slave state just drove Kansas Territory into war with Missouri, pro-slavers coming across the border and attacking the Yankees and driving them back to Boston and New York, wherever they were, where they were from. And John Brown went out there with a wagon load of pistols and broadswords, and he got to work. And by the time he was finished in Kansas Territory, a couple guys had lost their heads and their lives, and he had become the scourge of the West in some ways. And then he came back to the East Coast after that. The Kansas wars were more or less settled down, and decided to attack America's biggest arsenal, which at that time was in Harper's Ferry. I mean, this is a white man that people just thought was absolutely crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't understand why he's not more well known. I suppose that's why I wrote the book. And I tried to write it in a funny way so that it wasn't like, this tragic, this is what you should know kind of book.
Well, that's the beauty of this story. I read Midnight Rising last year by Tony Horowitz, where we get the nuts and bolts historical viewpoint of John Brown's raid. But there was no Little Onion in the story. And Little Onion is the miraculous narrator of this story. And this is the brilliance of this whole thing, because that you're right. That's what gives us the humor. That's what gives us this completely different viewpoint of John Brown.
Yeah, I don't think his story is dramatic enough, and if you're a talented writer there are several good writers who have taken on his story and done really good work with it. And since that had already been done, I thought to come at it a little bit differently from the perspective of someone who, well, first of all, there were people in that, when John Brown was trapped at Harper's Ferry and the feds were closing in and they were surrounding him and started shooting in the windows and kicking in the doors, there were more, I'm pretty convinced there were more people in that room than we knew about.
Uh-huh.
And there were different accounts that recently are starting to kind of come to light, that the inference is, at least based on some historical accounts, there were more people in that fire engine house with John Brown when he was captured than were let on, and several more, several of them were black. And I thought it would be an entertaining and interesting way of looking at a story, not from a black perspective, but just from a different perspective. It kind of shines light on who he really was. I mean, he's defined a lot by that Harpers Ferry incident, but he was so much more than that. I mean, he was really a man who was he was the father of 12 kids. Deeply religious, didn't allow any swearing or cussing or any of that business around him. The 19 men that he took with him to Harpers Ferry were men of just almost unconscious bravery. I mean, these guys knew they were going to get, you know, going to get hurt bad.
Mm.
And also, you know, it should be said that John Brown actually, he captured Harpers Ferry. He captured America's largest arsenal of weapons and held it for a day and a half, and could have, like, backed out and gotten away to conduct his war on slavery if he hadn't sat there for, you know, a day and a half waiting for blacks to show up.
Uh-huh.
Now, he was convinced that blacks were going to come and swarm to the cause, and he really underestimated slaves' desire to get away from slavery as opposed to their desire to actually fight against it.
Did he actually describe it as hiving?
Yeah, he would say, you know, he'd say hiving the bees, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, The Good Lord Bird is a book of satire. You know, it's a book of satire and caricature. So everything is kind of exaggerated. You know, he stops in the middle of the day and he prays. He prays all the time. And he was very religious and he did pray quite a bit. But it's not a book meant to really be serious about the subject of race or slavery or anything like that. It's just a book to illuminate what it might have been like in a way that is interesting. And that's why Onion is such an important character, because of the way he talks.
You're right. Henry Shackelford's his real name, and we have this great way of discovering this document in 1966 in a box. This is very sweet how you came up with this.
Well, I had to figure out a way to play it out as a some important papers are discovered in a church fire in Delaware, and someone looks through it, and they had a narrative that was recorded by a deacon back in the 40s who claimed that another deacon who was there at the church told him this story. And, you know, basically, this is on 100, and this, the story is told in the voice of a 111-year-old black man who's telling what happened to him when he was 10 years old, when he was kidnapped or freed, if you will, by, you know, the great abolitionist John Brown.
And so, he was dressed as a girl.
And he was dressed as a girl because John Brown believed he was a girl, because that's how slave children in those days wore potato sacks, and they were almost unisex, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so John Brown mistakenly believes that little Henry is really Henrietta. And so he begins to, you know, he just mistakes him for a girl, and little Henry plays along and becomes Henrietta, and then he's nicknamed the Onion by John Brown, who considers her a kind of good luck charm.
And he's so sweet. I mean, here's this guy, John Brown, who is so stern and always declaiming about the Bible and all, but whenever Little Onion's around, he softens.
Oh, he loves the kid. And, you know, in real life, John Brown loved children, and he was very kind to animals, and he was a very kind person. I mean, he was just very moralistic. He had high moral standards, you know. And that could be said of many people on both sides of the political spectrum.
Hmm.
It just depends on where your moral bar, where your moral spear drops into the ground. But Even people who you don't agree with politically can be kind, you know. I mean, I get out of bed knowing that, you know, believing that. Just because someone doesn't agree with me doesn't mean they're not kind. It doesn't mean they don't love their kids. Uh-huh. And it doesn't mean that I can't sit down and have breakfast or, you know, hang out with them. Hmm. It's because someone's politics is different than mine. Doesn't matter to me that much. You know, as long as they can tell me a dirty joke, make me laugh, I'm all, we're good to go. I mean, it doesn't have to be a dirty joke, but a joke.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, John Brown was actually very kind, and he basically held that moral principle up that we, you know, that we have to treat every man and woman in this country equally, and God has spoken on it, and he felt that God had ordained him the kind of, you know, the minister of this particular issue. So that not only was he qualified to speak on it, but he was qualified to act on it too, you know, and act he did, you know.
The book is The Good Lord Byrd. James McBride wrote it. He joins us on the program today. I love the section where Little Onion is living in a whorehouse. That's just a fascinating section, and I'm sure this is just your imagination going wild here. This woman that he's in love with, she's an amazing character.
Well, he was in love with Pi. He was in love with this woman in a whorehouse who was a slave, but also a favorite slave, so she didn't have to live like most blacks did. And she had a lot of power because all the judges and all the people in town, you know, slept with her, so she knew them all, and they would do favors for her. And he loves her as well. And she's quite a character. I mean, she's a, you know, she's another exaggerated character from like the Wild West, you know, who had certain ideas, and you know, your standard hoop and hollering woman who just, you know, punch a man out, that kind of woman, but beautiful as well. Uh-huh. And she disappoints him. It moves him toward becoming a man, although he doesn't realize it at the time.
And Little Onion also has a very special relationship with one of John Brown's sons, and this particular son is most unusual.
Well, John Brown had several sons who joined him in his crusade against slavery. And one of the most dedicated was his 22-year-old son, Frederick, who was a big strapping guy who carried, and you know, he had so many weapons on him, he rattled like a hardware store. He was a big, imposing figure, but he was a gentle giant, and he was also a little slow. I don't use the word mentally retarded because that's not a word that I use anymore, but he was a little slow in his mind. Uh-huh. But he was very sweet, and he and Onion become very close friends. And indeed, it's their friendship that carries the first part of the narrative, because John Brown is, you know, he's a commander, he's giving orders, he's praying for an hour and a half while they're waiting for him to finish. But it's Frederick who teaches Onion how to ride a horse and how to shoot and how to hunt and how to live outdoors. And because Frederick is low, Fred is not that smart, he and Onion fall right in. They fall in together. Fred has the maturity of a, you know, 10 or 15-year-old, and Onion has the maturity. Although he's 10, he has the maturity of maybe a 15-year-old. So they become fast friends.
The book is The Good Lord Byrd. James McBride joins us on the program today. And the title refers to this magnificent extinct woodpecker.
Right, that's the ivory-billed woodpecker, big bird. And it was so beautiful that when people saw it, they'd say, good God, good Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So one of his feathers is used, you know, that bird is used as a kind of symbol that it's kind of a lighthouse throughout the book, you know, that marks a certain passage of time, and it marks members of John Brown's family, and you know, they use it as a kind of charm, and it's a piece of metaphoric symbolism.
There's something totemic about it.
Well, it's really, it's when you're writing a novel, you're always looking for things that will kind of that will marks for the reader, so the reader can come back to this thing and kind of, you know, lock into it. And so that's what that Good Lord Bird really is. It's just a marker for the reader.
And your previous book, Song Yet Sung, brought us into the world of Harriet Tubman, and she has a bit of a cameo in this new book.
Yes, she does. And she, in real life, Harriet Tubman was someone that John Brown really, really admired. And he referred to himself as captain, but he referred to Harriet Tubman as general. And, you know, most of Harriet Tubman's work was on the eastern shore of Maryland. That's where she really ran her Underground Railroad. And she was someone who was at this great meeting they had in Canada when John Brown gathered up all of the America's brightest and most militant blacks for a meeting to talk about his war against slavery. And Harriet Tubman was there. And so I thought it would be a good place for her to make a cameo appearance in this book. And indeed, she was supposed to be at Harper's Ferry. But like most things that happened that John Brown planned, they never happened when they were supposed to. He was supposed to leave on the 23rd. Said he had to leave a week early because the sheriff had figured out that he had 19 men staying in this little tiny house hiding out. And so they decided to search the house. So before they searched the house, John Brown took off. He just decided to attack a week early, leaving Harriet Tubman, whoever else had decided to come, out of the loop.
And the voice that you've got for this little onion, I just that to me, to hear the expressions, the way that little onion speaks and the way that little onion thinks, is the magical part of the book for me as a reader, to be inside Little Onion's viewpoint. And it must have been so fun for you to be the Little Onion, to get that verbiage the way it comes out. And that must have really been a treat to do that.
It was. It was the most fun. I mean, this was a difficult book to do, but it was great fun in that way. And I don't really feel that way about a lot of books that I write, because writing is so hard, you know. I mean, there's an educational component of writing. There's a sweat equity element, you know. I mean, writing a book is not as difficult as, say, changing a transmission in a car, you know.
Uh-huh.
I get it.
Yeah.
It's not like taking the motor out of a 1991 Volvo and swapping a new motor in. Like some guys say, well, that's really easy. Well, it's not easy for me.
Uh-huh.
But writing this book was, for me, a pleasure in many ways because it... Well, first of all, I was going through a very difficult divorce when I was writing the book. I had just gone through a difficult divorce as I was writing. And it was really just great to be able to plunge into this world and live there. You know, because you realize the people who lived in the West, the settlers, had a really difficult life. You know, I mean, the whole idea of, like, you know, white people having 200 slaves and then just sitting around eating supper is just so exaggerated. Most white people didn't own slaves, period. And those that did, it wasn't like, you know, they might own two or three, or, you know, maybe four. That was a lot. But they had to take care of their slaves, and their slaves became part of their family, and it was a web of relationships. It wasn't, you know, it was not really what we thought it to be. And this is at a time when, you know, you could drink a glass of water from the river and then just die from dysentery. You know, people just died when they were 20 years old, and that just, you know, people got sick and died. So, you know, when you walk around in that world as a writer, you really feel a lot, real grateful for what you have, you know, here today, particularly in America, you know. So it was great to just drop into Onion's world and describe what he saw, and to watch how he took it without complaint, you know, and just was real happy for what he could get, and didn't pine too much over things that didn't go right. Although he fell in love a couple of times and that hurt his heart, you know, he still managed to to move on. And what I like about Onion as a character, and I like that this in nonfiction and fiction characters, is that he was really honest about things, you know, about what he saw.
And he has just such a joyful mode of expression. Even when he's talking about really terrible stuff, from his viewpoint, I just kept laughing. I think this book is hilarious. I mean, just because of the way he talks and the stuff he thinks about, it's just wild.
Well, nobody wants to look. I don't want to read a depressing book about slavery,
right?
In American history, I've read enough of those.
Yeah,
I want to inform people about it, but I don't want to depress them, because look, as terrible as that time was, we came out of it a lot better.
Yeah.
And if we don't look back to that time and say, well, you know what, we learned from that. If we don't do that, then all those, you know, 600,000 people who died in the Civil War died for nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you have to look back and say, well, this is what it was. But you have to say it in a way that doesn't really make people feel bad about it, but rather makes them laugh, brings them some joy, and a little sorrow, too. But I don't think people mind you showing them things. I think they mind it when you tell them things. You know,
yeah.
I think Americans and readers, at least my readers, they don't mind when I try to show. I mean, when I say my readers, I mean people who read my books. I don't own people. People say my readers. I don't know what this. You know, people who read my books,
yeah,
who are kind enough to put their hard money down to read my books. I think that they don't mind you telling the truth, but no one wants to be put in a room and then just not allowed to move or to say, I didn't realize that, or I made a mistake, or I didn't know it was that way, and now I'll rethink it a little bit. And that's really what I tried to do with The Good Lord Bird, and what I try to do with all my work. And that's how I was taught to live, you know, to just show it and let people decide for themselves. I mean, for example, in The Good Lord Bird, you have slavers who are, you know, supposedly bad people who are really not bad at all. I mean, Chase, you know, one of the guys who kidnaps Onion is a slave, you know, a slaver, a pro-slaver. And he and Onion end up getting drunk together and becoming like brother and sister. And and that really, I mean, I'm sure that kind of stuff happened. And then you have a slave revolt that takes place. This, you know, this woman who led these slaves into insurrection. They were going to kill the minister and his wife, and they got caught. And, and the minister confronts her, and he asks, "Would you have done that? You know, you love me. You said you were my minister. I was your." And she said, "Yes." And she explains why, and she flips him on the subject of slavery, and he suddenly becomes a convert. He becomes an abolitionist after she explains to him why. And she says to him, "You taught me that God is no respecter of persons. You taught me that Jesus died for, and how could, you know, and so of course, and so, you know, of course I would, you know, I would kill you and your wife. I would hate myself for the rest of my, I would be miserable for the rest of my life, but I would have to do it." You know, she explains why she would have to do it, and it just flips him all the way around, and he becomes an abolitionist. I mean, these things, I'm sure these things really happened. And fiction allows you to portray them as if they really did happen, even if they didn't.
Well, James, reading this novel, The Good Lord Bird, reminded me of that feeling like I'm in the nightclub and you gotten up there and you got your instrument and you just start riffing and jamming and improvising and you just hit one of those things where you could just go on and on and on and you're just like, wow, you know that feeling?
Yeah, and I wish, you know, this book is 410 pages. It didn't feel that long when I was writing it, you know. And I don't like I don't like books that are long and boring. I just felt like it just started flowing downhill at a certain point, you know. It just went down smooth as a glass of water, you know. I just couldn't stop. I just had to go, you know, follow it to its conclusion. And I miss that character. You know, I miss Onion, and I miss his world. I miss John Brown and all the people from Kansas and the pro-slavers and the free staters. I miss all that.
Yeah. Well, it's really a fun read, and I see where you went to Oberlin. Were you there when Gary Steingart was there?
No, oh,
okay.
No. But Oberlin does have Ohio, and Oberlin in particular has some bearing in the John Brown story. John Brown's two of the 19 men that attacked Harper's Ferry with John Brown were from Oberlin.
Mm.
One was an Oberlin resident, and one was an Oberlin student. They were both black, or mulatto, if that's what they were referred to back in those days. And one of them, John A. Copeland, was a student who withdrew from Oberlin and went to Harper's Ferry, and was apparently very well liked by the authorities that had to hang him. In fact, the Andrew Hunter, who was the prosecutor, had an enormous amount of respect for John A. Copeland. Said, "This is as fine a young man as I've ever met, and this is a tragedy that he was misled into this, you know, this circumstance," or something to that effect. John A. Copeland was a very, very kind, very extraordinarily bright guy. And John Brown got a lot of support in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
He was very popular in Ohio. He was affiliated with Oberlin College. I think his father was a trustee. And, of course, I went to Oberlin as well. So Brown and I have that in common.
Well, we're running out of time here. I guess I was just waiting for that moment when they didn't really know it was John Brown inside the Harper's Ferry facility.
Inside the fire engine house, where he was trapped.
They didn't really know, and I think Jeb Stuart, who had met him in Kansas, walked up and under a white flag and banged on the door and wanted to know who he was. And then when he saw him, he said, "Osawatomie Brown!" Like he couldn't believe it.
That's true, yeah. That's true. Jeb Stuart had come across John Brown in Kansas. And in fact, John Brown had to be driven out of Harper's Ferry by a young colonel from the Virginia Military Institute named Robert E. Lee.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they had to bring in the heavy hitters to get John Brown out of Harper's Ferry.
Yeah.
And, it's true. And it's amazing that all these people lived at the same time. Jeb Stuart, Colonel Lee, Harriet Tubman, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln. I mean, these were, Frederick Douglass. These were, great Americans.
Well, it's quite a story, and we appreciate you joining us on the program today, James.
Well, thank you for having me. Delighted, as always.
The book is The Lord God Bird by James McBride. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. A number of years ago, I had a guest on this program who had a book that came out, and he got a big advance for it. It was on a major publisher. They expected big things from the book. It was turned into a Hallmark television show. And then this author essentially disappeared. He kept writing books. He kept publishing them. But he got on smaller presses and sold fewer books, and he put out a book back in 2009, and I nearly missed it. In fact, I did miss it until just recently. And we're going to make up for that and bring Larry Baker back to the show next week with his book that came out a few years ago. It's called A Good Man. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.